described it, these nations have considered riots and terrorist actions as protests in interventionist comments, which in effect incite rioters and terrorists.
We need to separate the riots from peaceful demonstration. Anyone in their right state of mind will understand the difference between these two and separate them. The reality is people do have legitimate right everywhere in the world. Indeed, in Iran, is part of the Iranian constitution. They have the right to demonstrate, but no one has got the right to commit riots and endanger people's lives.
Meanwhile, there have been plenty of instances of the Western government's widespread violations of human rights and suppression of peaceful protests in their own countries, particularly in the EU. Serious human rights violations, including corruption, human trafficking, racism, and discrimination, persist across Europe, while unemployment and poverty in many countries are nurturing extremism and conflict. Therefore, Iranian officials say the EU cannot impose sanctions on Iran as long as countries within the bloc are violating human rights.
Beijing's Great Hall of the People saw Xi Jinping, the Secretary General of the Chinese Communist Party, attempt to cement his power by setting out to clinch an unprecedented third five-year term as president. In his address to some 2,300 officials and delegates from across the country, he laid out his policies and lauded some of his government's achievements. Among those achievements, President Xi reiterated the validity of his harsh zero-COVID policies. Policies which, to this day, shut down major cities and operations in China sporadically and disrupt businesses in a world increasingly accepting of COVID-19 as a reality to live with. In fact, China's civil aviation predicts that by the end of next year, the country's air traffic, while double the current figures, will still be just 15% of what it used to be before COVID. The policy's toll on people's mental health, though, may have been the biggest cost of China's success in containing the virus. Repeated lockdowns has resulted in the Chinese youth developing gaming addictions, sleep abnormalities, and a reluctance to go outside. Of course, COVID wasn't the only thing President Xi discussed in his address. He called for accelerating the country's military development while China already spends the second largest military budget in the world after the US. The military plan aims to improve China's ballistic missile capabilities, develop various aircraft carriers, and establish overseas outposts. Xi can lay out such military development plans because he doesn't just hold the title of President of People's Republic of China or the title of Secretary General of the CCP. He is also Chairman of the Central Military Commission. Taiwan's relations with China, as well as the US, have been clearly defined in the One China policy. It is the diplomatic acknowledgement by the US that there is only one Chinese government and that the US can have no formal ties with the island of Taiwan, but rather with the Chinese government. The policy has a long history, dating as far back as 1949, after the end of the Chinese Civil War. But it was in 1979 when, under Jimmy Carter's presidency, the US finally established formal diplomatic ties with Beijing and thus severed ties with Taiwan and closed its embassy in Taipei. But in that very same year, the US also passed the Taiwan Relations Act, which meant that it would support the island's ability to defend itself by supplying it with arms. The US has always maintained strong informal ties with Taiwan. The One China policy was undermined much further during Trump's presidency, and not just because of former president's inflammatory remarks about China.
And then we had the horrible plague come in from China. Boy, oh boy, what they cost the world.
It was because after decades, Tsai Ing-wen, president of Taiwan, spoke to a U.S. president, breaking diplomatic protocol. Sino-US relations have only gone downhill from there. The biggest offense in the eyes of China happened when US House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited the island in August in a move that infuriated China. Since then, Beijing's resolve to reunify with Taiwan has only gotten stronger. Xi Jinping has time and again rejected any form of separatism, as well as interference in the island's affairs, as it considers Taiwan a part of its territory. Xi's call for accelerated military development could hint at his impatience over US meddling and his increasing resolve over following through with his reunification plans with Taiwan.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, my dear sisters and brothers from all around the world, I hope you're all doing well. You are here with me for a better life. And, I'm Bita, and I am somehow interested in ethical issues in Islamic way. And I'm really honored and I appreciate the time I have to talk about somehow ethical and moral topics with you. I wish you all enjoy the episode of today. Today, I'm going to talk about, the most important aspects of morals and ethics. As you know, morals and ethics is a kind of, a vast area that we cannot just limit it with categories or something like that. But in general, as you know, there are four main categories in ethical issues that I want to count them. One of them is wisdom, chastity, justice, and valor. The most practical form of ethics is actually valor, the hot topic of today that I'm going to talk about. And, I wish you just consider all of these and all the time you're going to spend listening to my audio, thinking about the way you are living, because you are listening to For a Better Life. And, I'm going to explain this issue more for you. First of all, I'm going to start with the meaning of valor. There are many misunderstandings and misconceptions about the meaning of valor, because most of the people get confused about the valor and cowardice. Maybe it's a big shock for you that I'm just, telling you that there is special similarities in cowardice and valor. But I'm going to leave you with this cliffhanger, and then we're going for a short break. Then we're going to come back and go on for our hot topic of today. Stay tuned.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to Me for a Better Life. We're talking about one of the most important and most practical aspects of ethical issues, valor. First, I'm going to read your poem about bravery, about being brave and courageous in this world. You may write me down in history with your bitter twisted lies. You may tread me in the weary dirt, but still, like dust, I'll rise. Just like moons and like suns, with the certainty of tides, just like hope springing high, I'll rise. You may shoot me with your words, you may cut me with your eyes, you may kill me with your hatefulness, but still, like air, I'll rise. This poem was a sign of bravery. If you ask me to explain it and define bravery in my own words, I just say I act on my conviction and I face threats, challenges, difficulties, and pains despite my doubts and fears. But generally, a brave is one who puts himself in some danger, then saves himself or someone else from this danger. Actually, there are many discussions about being a brave person, good or bad, because sometimes you may put yourself in big, irrational dangers only to prove that you are a brave person. But what is it? Is it valor, or bravery, or stupidity? I want to tell you that the problem of this question is the misunderstanding of the meaning of bravery. So, to elaborate this area, I'm going to tell you that there is a delicate difference between being a brave person and being a cowardice. Sometimes you are in a situation that you cannot choose whether you have to fight for something or you have to stay in peace or you have to be silent because there are many other aspects that will be damaged because you are acting like you're fighting with that matter. You know what I'm telling you? The thing is, most of the people just cannot understand the paradoxical confusion between cowardice and valor. We're going to go for a short break, then we'll come back and then I'll elaborate this issue more for you. Stay tuned.
We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is For a Better Life. You're listening to me and we're talking about an interesting topic about valor and bravery. I was telling you that there is a paradoxical content between these two areas. I mean cowardice and valor or bravery. I want to tell you that bravery doesn't mean that you have to act aggressively, that you have to always be ready to put your sword on the neck of the other people, on the enemy. Actually, bravery means to stay calm and choose wisely what to do and what not to do in different situations. A coward people, you know, a coward person is someone who is just searching for a way to run away from the fears, from the obstacles, from difficulties, and many think more. But when you are a brave person, you will choose whether you're going to face this risk, you're going to face this difficulty, or you're going to find a way to go through this obstacle successfully. And this is the difference, dear listeners. So there is a meaningful bond between wisdom and valor. And, you know, as I told you, these are the two aspects of ethical values. Therefore, whenever the holy imams found the circumstances fit for, you know, for use of sword, they resorted to force. And when conditions demanded patience and peace, they put their swords away and exhibited their valor. We cannot call this cowardice, as I told you, because coward is one who only due to the weakness of his heart bears the oppression of his enemy, and it is not the one who finds his strength ready for the confrontation. So, dear listeners, I'm going to tell you that actually valor and bravery is not something bad at all. But the balance that you have to find to walk on the edge of the sword is the key to this discussion. I want to end our discussion with a beautiful verse of Holy Quran. Surely Allah loves those who fight in His way in ranks as if they were a firm and compact wall. I wish you all enjoy the episode of today. This is all the time we had for our today episode. And I just want to tell you that you have to be brave. Just try to keep moderate in a wisely way. I leave you in a warm embrace of God. I wish you a blissful life. And assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, He knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, He knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, He knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, He knows.
The Limelight.
At a meeting in Brussels, Belgium on Wednesday, 12th of October, more than 50 pro-Ukrainian countries pledged to increase the delivery of more weapon systems to Ukraine. Meanwhile, at a recent UN Security Council meeting, the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said, providing weapons and ammunition to Kiev indicates the direct involvement of the West and Western countries in this war. The Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov said some countries are seeking to prolong the war in Ukraine. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The website libertarianinstitute.org has covered this story. The United States and its NATO allies are accelerating transfer of arms, warm clothing and anti-drone technology to Ukraine in preparation for months of bitter combat through the winter. Washington believes shoring up frontline forces before modern ice set in will help Kiev to hold ground over the coming season. Speaking on the condition of anonymity during a recent NATO summit in Berlin, Germany, a Western official told reporters that the alliance had already started providing winter clothing, gear, to the Ukrainian side. The anonymous official said, "The Ukrainians are on their front foot and they certainly feel prepared for the winter campaign, and that foreign aid is currently very much focused on the winter." While top officials acknowledge that the snow, mud and ice of winter will slow troop movements, they believe Kiev can continue to push counter-offensives against Russian soldiers despite the frigid temperatures. America's Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said after a meeting in Brussels, Belgium, he said, I expect that Ukraine will continue to do everything it can throughout the winter to regain its territory and to be effective on the battlefield. Russian President Vladimir Putin has vowed to use his entire arsenal to defend all of Russia, including four recently annexed regions of Ukraine, which voted to join the Russian Federation in a referendum recently. NATO Secretary-General Jens Stoltenberg has echoed Lloyd Austin's claims about Ukraine's chances to make progress against the Russians during the cold season. Jens Stoltenberg said, "Our task is to enable them to also be able to conduct meaningful operations throughout the winter months and continue to supply them with everything from fuel, winter clothing, tents, to advanced weapon systems." Kiev has heavily depended on the West to train its soldiers and supply arms, ammunition and battlefield intelligence since Russian forces started their special operation in February of this year. In that time, the White House has approved at least $70 billion worth of aid to Kiev, much of that devoted to heavy weapons and vehicles, including long-range multi-launch rocket platforms, artillery pieces, shoulder-fired rockets, helicopters and drones. Though U.S. stockpiles have become increasingly depleted after countless rounds of arms shipments, the flow of aid appears set to carry on at the present pace, with the U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin recently declaring that Washington will continue to do everything we can to make sure that they have what's required to be effective. NBC News has also covered the same story. Amid skepticism that a new Congress could withhold military aid to Ukraine, lawmakers from both major U.S. political parties are looking to lock in billions of dollars in military assistance to Kiev before new members are sworn in this January. A lawmaker and congressional aide said, on condition of anonymity, the package being contemplated would be dramatically larger than the $12 billion in military and economic aid the U.S. Congress approved recently for Ukraine. A Republican senator said the amount would be enough to make sure that Ukraine can get through the year, adding, it'll make the $12 billion look like pocket change. Congressional aides and a source close to the Ukrainian government said the new aid package, which most likely would be part of an omnibus spending bill, could be within the range of roughly $50 billion. According to NBC News, which also noted that the Biden administration has not yet made a formal request for new funding, U.S. Congress has allocated a total of $65 billion in funding for Kiev since Russia began its special military operation in Ukraine in last February, pointing to concerns that a new Congress could take a more skeptical view of aid to Ukraine. The U.S. broadcaster NBC News underlined that both Republican and Democratic legislators currently in power are looking to lock in the huge military aid package before new members due to be elected in the upcoming midterm elections on 7th of November take office in January. Many Republican candidates endorsed by former President Donald Trump have challenged the amount of American aid already shipped to Ukraine, arguing that the United States has more pressing domestic issues to deal with, and the fate of Ukraine is not tied to American national interests, and that European allies should be delivering a larger share of weapons and other aid to Kiev. Meanwhile, President Joe Biden attacked the position of Republican politicians on Ukraine on Thursday, 20th of October. However, right-wing House Republican lawmakers argue that America needs to shore up its southern border with Mexico and address the issue of illegal immigration before worrying about the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Euronews has also covered the same story, but from a slightly different angle. The United States has announced its plan to supply Ukraine with more deadly weapons, despite Russia's repeated warnings to the West about exacerbating the conflict. The Pentagon announced on Monday, 17th of October, that the first batch of National Advanced Surface-to-Air Missile Systems, or NASAMS, will be sent to Ukraine within the coming weeks. The ground-based short-to-medium-range missile system, also known as the Norwegian Advanced Surface-to-Air Missile System, aims to aid the Kiev military as more attacks are launched against Russian targets. Meanwhile, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said on Tuesday, 18th of October, the alliance will deliver aid defense systems to Ukraine in the coming days to help the country defend itself against Russian drones, which are targeting critical infrastructure in Ukraine. Ukraine said attacks by swarm of drones had destroyed almost a third of its power stations in recent days after Russia stepped up its attacks on infrastructure far from the front line after suffering a string of military setbacks at the hand of Ukrainian troops. Addressing a security conference in Berlin, Germany, NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg said the answer to the attacks was the Allies to step up their deliveries of air defense systems. He said, "The most important thing we can do is to deliver on what Allies have promised, to step up and deliver even more air defense systems to Ukraine." Jens Stoltenberg added, "NATO will in the coming days deliver counter-drone systems to counter the specific threat of drones." Also, Britain's Defence Secretary Ben Wallace says Britain will supply Ukraine with advanced air defence missiles capable of shooting down cruise projectiles following Russian strikes on Kiev and other Ukrainian cities in recent days. The missile authorised for shipment to Ukraine is called the Advanced Medium Range Air-to-Air Missile, or AMRAAM.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the role models of faithfulness. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the role models of the faithfulness in the Islamic lifestyle. We know that when we talk about the lifestyle, we must have someone to follow. There must be a role model. In the history, in the Islamic history, there must be some people or the leaders or the leading personalities must become the role model so that when we see them, we can follow them. And if we cannot follow them, if they cannot become the role model, then obviously we cannot apply the Islamic lifestyle in our daily life or in our life. Therefore, when we look at the Islamic teachings, we see that, for example, in the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when he talks about one of the role models in chapter 19, verse 54, he says, وَذْكُرْ فِي الْكِتَابِ إِسْمَعِيلَ إِنَّهُ كَانَ صَادِقَ الْوَعَدِ. He says that, remember, in the book, the prophet Ismail, that he was one of the truthful ones who used to fulfill his promise, his covenant with the others. Now, when we refer to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam about this verse, he said that one day, Hazrat Ismail, the prophet Ismail, he made a promise to see someone at a specific place, out of city. So he went there and he was waiting for the person, but the other person forgot to come to the place and see Hazrat Ismail, the Prophet Ismail. And therefore he waited there until the companions of the Prophet Ismail, they got worried that why the Prophet is not coming back. Therefore one person went there and he asked him that, why you're not coming? We are worried about your absence. He said, I made a promise to that person to see him here, but he hasn't come yet. Therefore, his companions went after the person. They found him and they brought him to the prophet. And he said, "Oh, prophet, I apologize because I forgot that I have a commitment to see you at this place." And the prophet Ismail said, "Even if you were not coming, I was waiting until you come. And since you came, now I can leave." So this is what the prophet's personalities teaches us. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the role models of the faithfulness in the Islamic lifestyle, and we gave the example of Prophet Ismail. Similarly, when we look at the life of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, we see that even a day, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he has made a promise to see someone at a specific place. And that place, when the sun rays, obviously there was a hot weather and it was too hot. So companions of the Prophet has said to him to go to the shadow. And he refused. He said, "Because since I have made the promise to see him at this place, I will wait until he comes." So these things shows us that how the prophets, when they used to make a promise to someone, how they used to be faithful to that. And obviously, when they are at the position of a teacher, they're basically teaching us, they're telling us that no matter when you made a promise, whether it's a hot weather, whether it's a cold weather, whatever it is, you must fulfill the promise, because the important thing is to fulfilling the promise. The important thing is to fulfill the covenant and be faithful to what you have said, so that your tongue, your speech has a value amongst the people. Therefore, it is necessary to be faithful. On the other hand, we have the example of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, the fourth Imam, where he took some loan from someone, and as a security, he gave him a piece of thread. So when the time came when he wanted to give back the money, he went to the person and he asked him to give back the thread, a piece of thread. He said that it was nothing, it had no value, so I lost it. But Imam said, "Until you don't bring it, I will not give you back the money." So when he found it, he brought it, Imam said that, "Look, this piece of thread is of no value, but when it has become a security, and we promise that you will give me back this piece of thread and I will give you the money back, then obviously it has a value." Why? Because it is the part of the covenant that we have made, the promise that we have made. Therefore, it is necessary to be faithful to the promise and covenant that we make, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com iribe.org/en.
In the limelight.
The Islamic Republic of Iran is taking long and rapid strides in the fields of science and technology. This is an undeniable fact and cannot be ignored even by Western journals, which rarely cover the achievements of Iran. Science Journal has recently published an article on Iran's world-class 3.4-meter optical telescope. Science describes the Iranian achievement in this way. In a major milestone for Iran's scientific community, astronomers have announced recently in Tehran that the Iranian National Observatory, INO, has seen first light. The world-class 3.4-meter optical telescope, whose future appeared cloudy just last year, is operational and has acquired its debut images. Stay tuned to know more about this Iranian achievement. In a major milestone for Iran's scientific community, astronomers announced recently in Tehran that the Iranian National Observatory, INO, has seen first light. The world-class 3.4-meter optical telescope, whose future appeared cloudy just last year, is operational and has acquired its debut images. "We have been waiting for this moment for so long," says INO project director Habib Khosrow Shahi, an astronomer at the Institute for Research in Fundamental Sciences, IPM, in Tehran. First light for the $25 million observatory comes at a turbulent time, Khosrow Shahi acknowledges. INO's scientific odyssey began 2 decades ago and faced long odds. "When they started this project, it was just a dream. No one in Iran had attempted anything on this scale before," says Jerry Gilmore, an astronomer at the University of Cambridge and chair of INO's International Advisory Board. Last year, some former INO personnel voiced concerns about whether changes to INO's design might compromise its performance. "Those doubts have been put to rest," says optical engineer Lorenzo Zago, a consultant and advisory board member. INO opened its Dome for Sky calibration on September 27th, and the next night imaged 282 ARP, a pair of galaxies some 319 million light-years from Earth. The image's resolution, 8/10 ARC seconds, and that of a second image taken a few days ago, 65/10 ARC seconds, are close to the limit set by atmospheric conditions at INO site, 3,600-meter Mount Gargash in central Iran. Gilmore says that resolution's spectacular, much better than expected. "The science run, which hopefully starts next summer, will show the quality of the design and construction," says Reza Mansouri, a theoretical astrophysicist at the Sharif University of Technology who led the project until 2016 and who last year expressed worries about the telescope's future. Engineers still need to complete tasks such as integrating software, fine-tuning the active optics, and installing the first science instrument, a high-quality imaging camera. Initial science goals include probing galaxy formation evolution and stellar evolution and hunting for exoplanets. The Iranian Observatory and two others in the region a 4-meter infrared telescope in Turkey, nearing completion, and a 3.4-meter optical telescope in India, fill a geographic gap in a global network that keys in on fleeting phenomena such as gamma ray bursts to try to pinpoint their locations and unravel their physics. Gilmore says you need a chain of telescopes all around the world to follow up. In building INO, astronomers in Iran had to surmount hurdles that few colleagues elsewhere face, sanctions that curtail high-tech imports, and visa restrictions limiting their travel abroad. The Iranian team purchased the glass mirror blanks from a German firm. INO engineers then had to figure out how to construct nearly everything else on their own. Zago says, "What surprises me is that the know-how came so fast. They have been working like hell. At every stage, they increase the project's ambition and complexity," Gilmore says. For example, he says, when so-called active control systems, including sensors, actuators, and software that position a primary mirror, first became available for larger telescopes about a decade ago, INO engineers incorporated those into design. What's truly astonishing, Zago says, is a precision vacuum chamber that INO engineers and an Iranian company fashioned to coat the blanks with aluminum, transforming the polished glass into telescope mirrors. When the United Kingdom in 2000 set out to build an aluminizing system for its visible and infrared survey telescope for astronomy, Gilmore says, it took us forever to get right. Khosrow Shahi hopes to forge partnerships with international teams that might install state-of-the-art instrumentation in INO's 4-instrument slots. He says, "The door is open for our side, though sanctions and politics could stymie some potential collaborations. In the meantime, Iran's burgeoning astronomy community, just a couple of dozen strong, at the project's outset, but several hundred scientists and students today," Khosrow Shahi says, "is looking forward to some serious stargazing. We fought with disappointment, darkness, and also with words that could discourage us," says IPM's Maryam Turki, adding, "but in the end, we witnessed this glorious birth."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith based on understanding. Saturday, the 4th of Ramadan, 1394, 21st of September, 1974. Today we will look at a few more verses on the topic of faith. There are a few points we must consider. Firstly, Faith is one of the foremost qualities of God's prophets and the true believers who follow them. They have faith in their own message. This is the difference between divine leaders and the political leaders of the world today. A divine leader, as someone who follows this path, by whatever he says, by every step he takes, by the path that he follows, with all of his being, is a sincere believer. On the other hand, the world's political leaders might sometimes say nice things and give moving speeches, but this does not necessarily mean that they necessarily believe in what they say to even the slightest degree. There is a story about the leaders of one of the communist nations of the Eastern Bloc, who professed atheism and utterly rejected any culture or philosophy that was not based on materialism. This story takes place shortly after the Indian independence. In order to win the hearts of the massed millions of Indians who have just won their independence, these leaders visit India.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
There, the people of India were amazed to see that the leaders of this communist nation had Tilaka marks on their foreheads. Tilak was one of the leaders of the Indian independence movement, as well as a Hindu religious scholar. He was one of the greatest leaders of the Hindu religion, and both a leader and a pioneer of the independence movement for a period of time. It is worth me taking some time to mention this to you, even though it is not directly relevant to our present discussion, because it is good to know about such things. From beginning to end, the Indian independence struggle lasted 90 years, and from the beginning to end, its most important leaders were all men of religion, whether Muslim or Hindu. Some of the most important Muslim leaders were Maulana Shah Mahmud Dehlawi, Maulana Mahmud al-Hasan, Maulana Abul Kalam Azad, Maulana Muhammad Ali, and Maulana Shaukat Ali. In any case, when these communist leaders, who espoused atheism and materialism, went to India, in order to win people over to their cause, they put the tilak mark on their heads. In other words, they wanted to say, "Yes, us too, we believe the same as you." This, even though their own words and beliefs contradicted this statement. Those political leaders who are removed from spiritual, religious, or divine responsibilities are like this. But the prophets of Allah believed in whatever they spoke with the totality of their being.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
People from all walks of life rallied in the Gaza Strip following the Friday prayer in solidarity with Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Protesters shouted slogans decrying the Israeli crimes in Al-Quds and in the occupied West Bank. In recent days, extremist Jewish settlers, backed by Israeli forces, have been violating the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. Israeli attacks usually increase during Jewish holidays. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, which organized the rally, warned the Tel Aviv regime against crossing the red lines at Al-Aqsa Mosque compound.
Armed resistance is the only choice for Palestinians to fight the occupation. The Zionist enemy is playing with fire by attacking Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Palestinian resistance in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds is growing stronger. The Zionists are adding fuel to the fire, and it may only burn them.
Protesters in the Gaza Strip vowed to step up their support for Al-Quds until the end of all the Israeli violations in the Holy City. They also reiterated their adherence to resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds.
We call on all Muslims to defend Al-Aqsa Mosque because it belongs to all Muslims. We call on our brothers and sisters in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds to increase armed resistance against the Zionist enemy. The whole world must understand that we are willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Al-Aqsa Mosque is Islam's third holiest site and has been under Israeli occupation since 1967, while Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the capital of their future state.
We are here today to condemn the continued Israeli attacks against our people in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. The Palestinians are fighting for a just cause, and they will continue to fight until they regain their freedom.
Palestinians maintain that continued Israeli infringements upon Al-Aqsa Mosque will only increase the resistance against the occupation.
Observers say the international community has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds while turning a blind eye to Israeli violations against them for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
It's been just a few weeks since the now resigned Prime Minister, Liz Truss, promised low taxes and high growth. Events have moved incredibly fast in Westminster, that a new finance minister is now raising taxes and promising public sector cuts. The U-turns and counter-U-turns have come with a cost for the economy and the people. A new study has found that millions of households are skipping meals or struggling to put healthy foods on the table. Inflation is already at more than 10%. Energy and fuel prices are on the rise, putting a squeeze on Britain's finances.
Well, the start of all this is Brexit. Brexit led to Boris and incompetence. It led to falling living standards. It led to Liz Truss and further incompetence. And Britain basically voted to become poorer by leaving the EU. You can blame some of it on money printing at the Bank of England, inflation taking out, you know, and lowering living standards as well. So it's a combination of things.
A combination of things that have toppled two prime ministers in the span of 1 year.
It's been less than 2 months since Boris Johnson gave way to Liz Truss as prime minister, followed by the death of the Queen and a dramatic change in the country's economic outlook. And now, yet another leadership contest that could trigger even more economic and political instability.
And more instability means more people relying on charities, from food banks to keep their stomachs full, and warm rooms where those unable to heat their homes can take refuge in the cold months of winter. The new chancellor has curbed Liz Truss's flagship economic plan of a 2-year cap on energy bills to April next year. And at the end of this month, he's expected to announce a midterm economic policy that could spell out the beginning of another prolonged period of austerity.
Whoever takes over, Boris, Rishi, Mordaunt, who knows? But the outlook continues to be bad because inflation is still out of control. There's not the money or the government finances to give the public sector further wage rises to match that inflation. Strikes will continue. The fiscal position of the country remains dire, partly because we have a smaller economy because of Brexit. So there's no easy solution. There's no easy way out of this. The hole has been dug and it's very deep and very difficult to climb out of.
Paying the price of that, ordinary Britons, as the Conservative Party races to choose its third leader and prime minister in 1 year, urgent help to those in need, couldn't come any sooner. Saeed Pourreza, London.
EU leaders at a summit in Brussels agreed China is becoming too assertive. It's the same phrase they have been using for years with respect to Russia. Iran was also in their sights. New restrictive measures against Tehran were rubber stamped.
Sanctions have been taken against those who are participating in the repression of peaceful demonstrations. And this, of course, is linked to the support of Russia against Ukraine.
Analysts say the allegations against Iran are spurious and they are being vehemently contested. It's pointed out that the bloc sometimes ignores clear international law violations, even when there's zero ambiguity, for example, those perpetrated by Israel against Palestinians. The US is said to have even greater influence over the EU as the bloc moves to try and isolate Moscow and Beijing. It's suggested that has been Washington's plan all along.
Europe, they are totally dependent on the United States and in energy field and in military field. And that is dependency that doesn't allow them to conduct independent foreign policies.
Sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have driven energy costs to unmanageable levels. A complex package has been agreed in principle by EU leaders to try and lower prices and demand.
There's a lot of work now ahead of us what the energy is concerned, but the roadmap is very clear. And it was good to have this unanimity, this broad support for the roadmap that we have put forward.
Leaders admit the energy package is very complex and will take up to 3 weeks to try and finalise. Will this summit deliver positive results for EU citizens? It's a crucial question for millions of households and businesses, but also a vital political question for the bloc's leaders. Extreme left and extreme right anti-EU parties are waiting in the wings. Ignoring massive corruption findings by their own financial watchdog, EU leaders have agreed to provide €18 billion to the Ukrainian government in 2023. But that's nothing compared to what they will spend on lethal weapons for the country's army. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A draft law aiming to punish anyone caught wearing a full face covering has been proposed in Switzerland. If passed, Muslim women caught wearing a niqab or a burqa could be fined up to $1,000. A far-right proposal to totally ban facial coverings in public has already become law, winning a narrow victory in a referendum in 2021.
The ban was pushed by the Swiss People's Party, with one of its parliamentarians arguing that the ban would promote equality between men and women and would also help to fight back against so-called Islamic radicalization.
Muslim organizations have expressed concern over rising Islamophobia in Switzerland and condemned the move as hypocritical.
So the Swiss cabinet says that this general ban on face covering is about the safety and safeguarding of citizens. But why not make an exemption for the niqab? I mean, it's not like there's a crime spree of niqabis across the country. That's just ridiculous. And, you know, jokes aside, what is going on here with vilifying a well-known symbol of the Muslim faith is that Muslims would then, as a community, be seen as divisive and criminally minded if we so much as speak up in support of the niqab.
Laws which negatively affect Muslim women are springing up across Europe. France banned wearing full-face veils in public in 2011, whilst Denmark, Austria, the Netherlands and Bulgaria have full or partial bans on wearing face coverings. Muslims make up only around 5% of the Swiss population. Yet, how Muslim women choose to dress remains a major obsession of right-wing lawmakers. Robert Carter, London.
Another Palestinian young man, seen by many as a hero and an icon, has been killed by Israeli forces during a confrontation in the occupied West Bank. For more than 10 days, the regime's forces had been carrying out a manhunt for Uday Tamimi after he shot at an Israeli military checkpoint at the entrance to his hometown, the Shafat refugee camp in Al-Quds. On Wednesday night, he was gunned down during clashes with Israeli forces at the entrance of an illegal settlement in eastern Al-Quds called Ma'ale Adumim. Hearing a call from Palestinian factions, a general strike has been held in Al-Quds, and throughout the occupied West Bank to mourn at Tamimi. The walkout affected all public institutions and private sectors.